You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller. So, gentlemen, Scott Kirby, Scott Kirby has informed us, the public, that leaving JFK, United leaving JFK, was a mistake.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's kind of how it feels.
I'm thinking he's wrong on that.
I mean, this was sold to us as JFK was a losing proposition for United. They were losing money.
They were. I mean, there was five at that point. There was five carriers. AA and Delta were dumping capacity into the market
to try to piss JetBlue off, because JetBlue had just shown up with something so much better and cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, because if you think about it, when PS came into being, Delta wasn't really flying there. Yeah. AA was, but they had a finite number of flights because of the 762s. And you know, it wasn't. It was before they went hourly on LA. So there was a lot less capacity. It was before JetBlue. It was before Virgin.
I don't want to go so far as to say I think he's wrong, but I also don't know that he's necessarily right. Or he's probably a little bit of both.
I think his comment is being taken out of context. I mean, his comment, if you really dug into it, was it made sense because we had a big hub at Newark. It also, the losing proposition was we lost some corporate customers in the process.
That's right. And it's not even that we lost them outright. It was... I mean, he names a couple business. I think it's like Disney and someone else. He said we had an exclusive contract, and then they had additional options. Right. It wasn't that none of these people flew with us anymore. It's that some of them started flying other carriers as well. And right, part of the challenge is network. If you lose a customer over to Delta because they want to go to JFK instead, or American because they want to go to JFK instead of Newark, then you might also lose them on the LA Heathrow flight or the LA Tokyo flight.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that from the sort of big picture network perspective. At the same time, I don't think that it's fair to say it destroyed United's corporate contracts, or that you can judge that in isolation from the fact that during these last couple of years, while they've not been at Newark, United has also sort of been an operational nightmare.
Yep.
That would be enough to push me to Delta if I was a corporate flyer. And based in LA, right? Also, like, the number of routes, other routes from Los Angeles that United had nonstop service has dropped. I know, Stephen, you've lamented the Portland cuts.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, and all that was kind of happening at the same time, right? That the JFK was going around. Like, that. I mean, that's a reason to dump them. If they're not going to fly where you're going nonstop, then...
I certainly respect that some corporate contracts walked away or diversified, blaming it solely on... that and say and the implication that had we kept those 16 flights a day or so at JFK, we would have kept all those customers is, I think, a bit imaginative.
And to be fair, he said we were not considering coming back to JFK, or we're considering it, but we not seriously right now.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was mentioned is that one of the reasons they decided to leave when they did was because their lease at Terminal 7 was expiring.
Right.
Yeah, so they don't own those gates.
No, that was a BA.
No, they leased it from BA, right?
Yeah, BA owns that building.
Gotcha. It's interesting that Kirby handles a lot of this stuff, and he has some insight from his American days into the whole premium transcon market, right?
I mean, we all thought three cabin F on those transcons was a joke, but Americans still fly in it.
Yep. Well, he even came out and made a statement that, you know, when he was at American, like, their sole job was to dethrone United out of JFK. That was their goal.
Hmm. Yep.
And so did they buy a bottle of champagne for JetBlue when that happened?
I think so.
Right? I mean, he's going to claim that they did it. They succeeded, but they didn't succeed on their own.
Nope. But yeah, I agree.
It is. Yeah. I, you know, it would be interesting to read a... history of JFK and the airlines that have come and gone. I mean, you could do that for a lot of airports, but JFK in particular, because of all the international service and the market that it serves, I think it's fascinating.
If we just talk about United itself, and we had an offline chat about this, but the JFK was important in the 90s because it was part of the around the world service.
Yeah.
And that was one of the key things, because they would fly at JFK, LA, and San Francisco would be JFK LA would be one flight, JFK San Francisco would be other. And then going the other way, it'd be going through Heathrow, then on to Delhi, then on to Hong Kong, back to San Francisco or LA.
Hmm. So there's a little bit of historical pride there too for United. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean they also had the Buenos Aires service. They had Tokyo service, right? I mean, like, they did have a bunch of destinations from JFK, and in the mid-2000s, Hong Kong,
I think, was the other
one. Yeah. And then, you know, they went bankrupt and had to figure out what to cut. And the sort of prestige routes from a non-hub where you have no feed when you're trying to be a hub-and-spoke airline kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, American did the same thing and retreated to its five-corner strategy or five-star strategy, whatever the heck they call it, with their five main hubs before still going through the bankruptcy and merger scenario. It's tried and true, as it were. Who knows whether that's been truly successful or just, you know, successful enough to get airlines to the point where fuel prices came back down, but fares are staying high these days. So they're actually making money. But this is not something that only United has ever done. United clearly did it in sort of two big stages, dropping all the international a decade ago and then a couple of years ago dropping the transcon routes. Plus Dulles. Don't forget Dulles. I get where he's coming from. I can see how it was a problem in that it opened up some corporate contracts for other players, other airlines. But I think that saying that was the problem as opposed to we had a lot of problems and that was one of them is a interesting revision of history.
Yeah. And we can have the conversation some other time, but I think corporate contracts, I can understand people wanting to fly into JFK, I guess. Newark's not that bad. I mean,
it depends on where you're going, obviously.
Yeah. If you're going to Brooklyn, I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically what's really, you know, the line is really through Midtown, right? East side, you're better off going to JFK. West side, you're better off going to Newark generally.
Yeah. But I mean, for me, I'd say the one downside for Newark is having to take PATH and New Jersey Transit. Like, that would be, if I wanted to go the public transit route at JFK, I have the option to just take the subway all the way in. I mean, it takes a long time, but it's there.
Not that bad. I do it all the time.
And it's what, $7.50, I think, right? When you do the AirTrain transfer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or $8. I think we're up to $2.75 for a regular ride plus if you're a one time rider, it's $2.75 plus $2.50 or plus $5 plus $1 to buy a card.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
If you do it frequently, you can buy a 10 trip for the subway for the AirTrain.
Yep.
It knocks the price down, so it's $25, which is actually $26 because you can't refill that card.
See how we
even though I have it, still want to reuse it, I can't, so I have to buy a new one every time, and it pisses me off. It's $26 for my 10 rides instead of 51.
And I don't know if you know this, that is a Port Authority decision, not an MTA decision.
To not allow that to be a refillable card?
Yep.
Okay, well.
Just like you can't roll over, you know, on an MTA card, when you have credits, you can roll it over to a new card. The Port Authority, the AirTrain cards, the Port Authority has deemed that you're not allowed to do that.
Even like just cash value?
That's what they claim.
So you're saying if I buy a $50 card?
No, the 10 trip.
Oh, yeah, that I believe.
Yay, Port Authority, right?
More corrupt than the city of Chicago.
So I mean, I think like my whole point with that was, I think it's, I mean, I used to fly into Newark pretty often and was usually going to Brooklyn or even the east side. I was going to like north, I was going to the Bronx sometimes, I was going to E16th, depending on which office I was at. So I never had a problem. I mean, I did get a few times I got stuck in traffic and it took me, you know, an hour and a half or whatever to get across Manhattan. But depending on
that one time I met you and we went out to Newark. And we end up in that stupid poster.
Yeah, we were on that. I picked you up. We were stuck in traffic, and you actually walked to the car.
We were stuck in traffic for a ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah.
So, that's an example where, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever. We probably would have had similar traffic going to JFK. So I don't want to say it's strictly a Newark problem. None of them are great, and especially for the next couple of years. LaGuardia even sucks because, like, oh yeah, you want to take a town car away from Newark, hop on the bus and ride over to this designated parking lot, and then we'll get you an Uber or a Lyft or even your regular town car.
Not a designated parking lot. We're going to drop you off on a random street corner somewhere in Queens.
Tomato, tomato. It is ridiculous. That whole thing, I like died laughing. I understand why they have to do it because the crowding and the construction, but like what a disaster that is. So What I'm getting at is transit to and from all the New York airports sucks. Or it's equally challenged, and saying that one of them is perfect seems to me a misnomer.
Yeah,
there are some that are better than others depending on where you are trying to get to in the New York side of things. And absolutely for people who live on Long Island, JFK was better.
Yeah,
no argument on that. I'm not sure it was better enough to justify keeping the 12 flights a day or 14 flights a day that they were running.
Yeah,
even knowing that some people now fly Delta to London and Tokyo.
Agreed.
So, and it's not like they, it's the other argument we hear is like you can't keep cutting to grow, which is true, but it's not like they wholesale like cut capacity out of the system. They cut those flights and moved them to Newark and were hourly to San Francisco for a while, right? I mean, I don't think they still are, but they've added a ton of capacity on transcons.
At some points it is, I think, almost hourly. I mean, there's some that are half an hour apart. So it depends really on the time of day, but I mean, I actually think they moved the flights over and then added more, quite candidly.
Yeah, and we've talked about capacity wise. I mean, they're now flying a 777, a 77W in the new plane on San Francisco Newark, and they're filling it. So there is a demand. People do want to fly to Newark, and people do need to connect elsewhere through Newark. Is it all bad? I don't know. I mean, operationally, you would hope it helps things. Although, from what I've heard in San Francisco, gate wait times can be a real headache for United flights.
I mean, the advantage given them is when they have challenges with fleet, they can sub in a different plane at Newark.
Yeah.
At JFK, there were times when I saw flights there would be 6-8 hours delayed just because they had to wait for the plane.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we killed that story. I want to talk about street.
Everybody's
food.
Right and everybody sucks. That's the conclusion we came to, right?
Exactly. Let's talk about street food. Bangkok had announced they were going to ban street food carts this coming year, like next year, 2018.
No, like by the end of this year, it would be done.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay, I thought it was 2018.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And there was kind of an uproar on Twitter, online, just in general. I think people were upset about this because that was part of the experience of going to Bangkok, is eating street food and enjoying the outdoor markets in the city.
They seem to have backed down a little bit from it, moving more towards you have to be licensed and hygienic.
Okay.
Which, you know, I can support that to some extent. I like my stomach working in normalish levels.
Yep.
But it's obviously that's still going to have an impact, right? There's going to be a lot of people who are affected by that sort of move, licensing especially.
Yep.
I think more than the hygiene issues, I think most of the stuff was relatively clean enough. But it's remains to be seen just what the implementation looks like. There's some other people that suggested that like the main roads they cleared out because it was just too crowded, and instead of people walking on the sidewalks were completely filled with shops or these little stalls, and there were too many people, and so it flowed out into traffic and it became dangerous and created traffic jams. And so they cleared out the hawkers from some of the main roads, but they're letting them, you know, still run on the back roads like one block in. So you might not see everything as you're walking down the main drag, but go back into the neighborhood a little bit and you will, which in many ways is probably good news for the neighborhoods. They get to keep the sort of culture, they get to keep the experience of the food, and it pulls people off the main streets, which lets you get a better experience, see more, get a little bit closer to the real world of those cities.
Yep, absolutely.
Or neighborhoods, yeah. So TBD, obviously, have to go back at some point and try it.
Yeah, and I mean, just real quick, I think like street food for me is the easiest way. It's the most introductory way to see a city and experience the culture, really, right? Like, I think you and I, Seth, went to Seoul, and we went to this, like, night market street food place.
Oh, yeah, I forgot we did that right when we landed, didn't we?
Yeah, and to me, that was, like, the best introduction to Seoul that I could have ever had.
And that was a fun one. That was, like, the food market in the middle of the fabric.
In the fabric district,
like,
yeah.
In the fabric district, right? So, like, there's all these buildings around that are selling wholesale fabrics to the rest of the world. So they actually work overnight because they're mostly selling to Europe and the United States.
Yep. And so there's these markets.
So the time zones that they have to be running are, you know, in the middle of their night. So like the market didn't get hopping until 10 o'clock, which is about the time we finally got there.
Yep.
And forgot about that. You sort of elbow our way in with some low seats at a stalls and pointed at random things. Some guy tried to offer us a weird milky beverage that we declined.
Pretty sure it was soju, I think. Not sure.
No. You think so?
I thought it was like
in a soda bottle.
Let me see. There's a Korean drink.
Soju is alcohol. I wouldn't have declined that.
I'm pretty sure. Let's see. Milky looking drink.
This has so much potential to go wrong.
I know. I'm just like, ooh. It's a bold search.
The things that I see aren't...
I think it was like a soda-y sort of thing. But either way, I did decline it that time. I think we may have managed to find beers that night, though.
We did. And we had a great little host that was... She was the shopkeeper, the stall keeper, and was showing us actually how to eat the food, which was awesome.
Yeah.
But to me, that's like the great way. So I've never been to Bangkok, but just hearing this news was kind of worrisome to me because I think that takes away so much from people visiting and getting to know, even if it's like a stopover, right? You're there for 24 hours and you can find street food and you're like, hey, I tasted a little bit of Bangkok while I was there, or I tasted a little bit of Seoul or wherever. It's just like whenever we go through Tokyo, we usually get sushi, all of us, whenever we're there. It's just like that kind of thing to me. I agree.
And one caveat is like those stalls in Seoul, that market was a permanent space dedicated to these things. It's different than what was being opposed in Bangkok, but still the concept of get local food, get it from someone who's serving it to a lot of locals. Hope you don't get sick is in my experience, a great way to visit a city. Don't lick your fingers. That's a bad way.
At some point, we're going to have you tell the India story. So not today.
Okay.
But at some point.
Today.
Because I've repeated that story to other people, and it's great. and that's my warning. Don't lick your fingers.
Lick your fingers.
So American Airlines has had an incident with a passenger and a stroller. And as with most incidents, we don't know the full story behind what's happening, but we do have video. And so by now, by the time the show airs, it's been probably a week since this video had aired, online. And from the descriptions, people say, oh, the flight attendant took it from the stroller from the woman and hit her and almost hit the baby. And then you see a gentleman get up in first class and say, I want this guy's name. And then the flight attendant comes back on board and this guy yells at the guy and just gets really escalated. What do you guys think? I mean, I've read some takes from flight attendants, but what do you guys think of this?
Have you read the statement from like the other passenger on board?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
The one that says it's not what it,
there's like
not
a face,
what it seems.
It's a Facebook post that it's, it's like a screen grab of someone's Facebook page basically saying it's not what it seems. The passenger was also like trying to get too much stuff on board and, you know, and I, at one level, like it sounds like the woman was traveling with a toddler and an infant.
Yep.
Twins.
The passenger. Are they twins?
Yeah, they were both young twins.
So same age, but like one was in her hand, the other was sort of walking. That's stressful. That's a crazy challenge. I don't envy that at all. Solo parent traveling with two little kids. But I think that probably had everything teed up for like, if one more thing goes wrong, I'm just going to explode. And one more thing went wrong.
Yep.
Is part of how I see this whole thing. Which we've talked about a lot of times. You get a bunch of people in the stressful world of travel, which is an environment made more stressful by a combination of airlines, airports, TSA and passengers.
Yep.
And every single time there's a potential for, you know, it's basically a powder keg.
Mm-hmm.
And well, anything can set it off.
What's interesting is like American issued an apology right off the bat and they actually reached out.
They got the PR right.
Yeah. They got allegedly upgraded the passengers connecting to somewhere beyond the internationally. And they upgraded her to first class all the way they claim. I mean, nice gesture. I don't know what the reality of it is, but I mean, definitely handled very differently.
Let's assume they didn't lie.
Yeah. So it was handled very differently than the previous incident. And, you know, the previous incident, you know, on the side note, seems like may have led to Oscar not becoming chairman.
Side note, is that like in a little, is there a little asterisk or something next to that?
It could be. Click here. It could be a hover.
I think something I posted online just.
And also, just as I'm sorry, just to throw this in there, my understanding is the flight attendant was suspended.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was going to say
that.
I think just from what I initially saw, like what I saw to me is just a societal kind of flux that we're in, and I posted this in a chat that we had. I feel like it's – I see it other places too. I see these things where the gentleman who stands up, I feel like could have de-escalated. He was seated in first class. He could have de-escalated the entire event by possibly just going, hey, you know what? Can I get that guy's name? And ma'am, by the way, you can have my first class seat. Like, just take the seat. I'll take yours. Make yourself comfortable. And then that's
– or, hey, can I help you move some stuff around?
Exactly. Exactly. Like, he could have – but instead he pushed. And when the flight attendant came back on, he again got out of his seat. And instead of saying, hey, may I speak with you privately, or can, you know, can I just get your name, or not even saying anything, he could have just left it alone. He got in this guy's face and kind of yelled at him, and the flight attendant yelled back, and they were both wrong. And I feel like this is just like what we are going through as a society. I see this kind of stuff where people escalate things when they don't need to be escalated, when we could be peacemakers rather than yellers at each other and make things worse. I don't know. And I've run into it. I've told the story before of how I got yelled at trying to help someone and in Chicago. And it kind of just really it was terrifying. But, you know, so I don't know. I feel like it's the video, besides the woman crying and the story there, I think there's this other dynamic going on where this guy gets up and he's like, I'm going to challenge you, you know, and you shouldn't have hit her, or you do that to me, I'll knock you out, I think is what he says.
I guess the question would be, like, if it, because allegedly there was a stroller thrown, if there, and that almost hit a kid. Now, that really is the case. I mean, I can understand, you know, a lot of people get emotional about a kid almost getting hit by someone's actions.
Yep.
You know, and someone like a flight attendant should know better to begin with.
Yep.
So I could understand why someone would get emotional. But, you know, if that wasn't the case, yeah, I would expect the guy to be a little more level-headed. But it's I mean, the reality is there's two sides. There's really three sides to every story, and we don't know what really happened, and we never will.
Yeah, but I would just encourage listeners, you know, if you see an incident, stand up for what's right, but there's no reason to answer violence with violence or answer a perceived wrong with more perceived wrongs. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no
– You're telling me two wrongs don't make a right?
But three do.
Oh, okay, perfect. Well, I mean,
four make a circle.
Exactly. So, well, I've said this on our chat, right? Where, like, right now, everyone's using these opportunities to just jump and hate on the airlines.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of pent-up aggression from people in regards to, you know, people are feeling nickel and dimed on one side. But, you know, the reality is airfares haven't really shifted much in 20 years
in
a lot of markets. So inflation's happened. There's been a fair amount of inflation over the last 20 years. But going cross-country is still about a $350 trip in most cases.
Yep.
You know, yes, some of the things have been debundled, but not like a lot of people used to complain. I'm not checking a bag. Why do I need to pay for a bag? I'm not eating the food. Why? So they've debundled them, but the traveling public will just never be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the idea of convenience and cost. Yeah. So, Emirates. Let's talk about them. Cutting flights and possible financial issues. Some people arguing that the cutting flights has to do with the Trump electronics ban, particularly.
I think it's bigger than just the electronics ban. It's policy in general, but I think that's a contributing factor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're right. This is sort of like, why did United leaving JFK? There's a lot of contributing things here.
Yep.
But to say that that's not part of it, I think misses a little bit of reality.
Yeah.
Emirates is dropping 25 weekly flights starting early next month, I think, like starting as of May 1st. A couple of them, one of them was they had a second frequency to LA that was already announced that it was being cut a while ago. Still after the first travel ban, but I think not before the electronics ban. That one was already announced. So that's currently a 380 and a 77L,
yep.
And they're dropping the 777, which is about a 260-seat plane. And then Seattle and Boston also lose a frequency and a daily frequency. They were both double daily, and they're both getting dropped down to one, which you could argue is just like a rational capacity switch.
Yep.
Those were double dailies on those seemed a bit aggressive anyways. And then Orlando and Fort Lauderdale, the two most leisure-focused destinations, are going from daily to 5X weekly each. And Fort Lauderdale's a brand new route. It only started in, like, November, I think, right?
Yeah.
Recent, like last fall. So it's – that adds up to 25 weekly cut. And it's – if you look at it, like, it's a lot of seats on average. I think – I'm trying to remember now what the number I came up with was, but it's – I want to say it's like 5,000 a week.
Wow. And that's all 777Ls? Is that
777Ls? No, There's two are the 777L, and then the rest are 77Ws.
Okay, so big planes. So it's a 77W is a big plane for them.
Yeah, it's like 350, 360 seats.
Yep.
Didn't one of the LA-380s get downgauged or 77W?
It was a 77L.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now they're cutting it.
And now they're cutting it completely.
I will say the LA flights were some of the easiest I've seen to book reward seats on. Like I was looking like last year. I mean, you could always find availability in first or business on the LA Dubai flights. Seattle, when the second double daily was added, also really easy to find seats on. So it doesn't surprise me all that much as far as like they must not have just been selling those seats. And now with the Trump policies in place, I think
it's it makes it harder to get a visa. It makes it harder to get in for a lot of people in the markets and parts of the world that were their focus. And by the way, to correct myself, it's 10,000 seats a week. It's a 500,000 a year.
Whew.
Being cut, which like is both is and is not a lot.
It's a lot from someone who's just listening to this podcast, you know?
Yeah. It's not like it's a drop in the bucket compared to the total number of seats flying, but it is still a significant move. And again, it's also only really bring Emirates back down to the capacity they were flying late last year.
And so that brings me to the question.
They're not rolling back like 3 years worth of growth.
Well, and that brings me to the question, Seth. Like there was an article posted on Runway Girl about how this could speak to other issues that were going on within Emirates. Did they grow? Did they over put too much capacity in the United States too quickly? Did they grow in markets they didn't need to necessarily grow in yet? You know, basically, did they grow too much too fast? And is this just a repercussion of that with the Trump policies adding on?
And so, yes, I think the short answer is yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah.
Right. Their growth was incredibly fast. It wasn't filling out anyways. And then we've now seen additional both economic challenges in general in some parts of the world, plus some policies have made it much harder to get a visa. I mean, shit, we even saw that people who had global entry had it revoked.
Yep.
Supposedly they got it back now, but like for having the wrong name, you got your global entry revoked. So it's a very challenged travel environment in general. And, you know, for people coming from the subcontinent, especially, which is a big part of where Emirates is pulling passengers into the United States, it's also very hard. Not that India is on the watch list necessarily, but there's been a lot of challenges, is my understanding, with getting new visas issued. Just the general process of getting a visa has slowed dramatically.
Yep.
And they have to apply for one. So it's, you know, if you don't already have one, it can be a brutal experience. And so if that's actually causing bookings to drop.
Yep.
Now, the flip side of that is Qatar Airways also significantly increased capacity, both into the United States, and it's trying to increase significantly into India. Hasn't gotten there yet, but it's trying. So that's also part of it, right? Like, it's not just that Emirates expanded too quickly. It's that everyone expanded too quickly, arguably.
Mm-hmm. And so they're competing. I mean, they're competing all the way through type thing.
Yeah. And there's also Etihad via Twitter sort of went on record as saying they don't plan to make any changes other than the previously scheduled upgauge of the second JFK flight to an A380. It's going to hold. So, and that's an extra 100 or 150 seats a day for them. Which, you know, call it less than 1,000 a week. So it's a very small way towards offsetting the 10,000 a week that Emirates is dropping.
Yep. Yep. Interesting times.
It costs a lot of jobs. That's right. That's the ultimate irony of all of this is like, how do you define which jobs are the right ones to save?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm using the word save very loosely. But.
Amtrak. Also, some potential cuts coming.
Like the whole long haul network.
Yeah, just a few cuts, you know.
And part of me is like, I still haven't done the long haul Amtrak train. Everybody I know who's done it enjoyed their sleeper car, and said that was great. Most of them said that was great. I don't ever want to do it again, because it's just so long. But even if you did want to do it again, I wonder, like, one of the people interviewed countering it was like, this is like a life-saving service that people use this to seek medical care and other things in some of these small communities. And I have a hard time believing that.
Yeah.
Also, I actually don't think this would go through because it's a budgetary thing, right? So this is part of Trump's proposed budget, which, if I understand things correctly, was a very light on details outline of sort of ballparks where things should be and which things should get cut. And he was expecting Congress to fill in the details. And with the exception of a very small number of states, Amtrak touches all of them. So that's the sort of thing that, especially in the Senate, gets support broadly because everybody helps everybody else out. It's an easy one where a couple people from some of the states that would be affected, mostly in, you know, the mountain regions and Midwest, can easily create trouble for everybody else.
Yeah. Yep.
Or, you know, counter that with, we can help you out on the other things you need if you help us out here. So arguably, like, that's why it still exists today. So expecting that to change suddenly seems unlikely to me.
Oh, I don't know.
I would blame them if they did.
Do they consider like the Vancouver down Vancouver BC down to Los Angeles or San Diego service long haul? I mean, is that considered long haul as well?
I think most of that was going to stay.
Okay.
There's also like, there was a weird one. I think Trump was trying to scrub the bullet train in California, but that wasn't going to happen because they're going to find local funding for it. Crud. I'm trying to find, someone had a map at one point. Now I can't find it. There was a lot of gaps in it, but, it's not, oh, here we go. Proposed closure. So, maybe the north-south was going to die.
Oh, parts man.
It looks like Seattle all the way north would stay, but like the Seattle to Portland section might go.
Well, there had been talks about that for a while, so I mean, that kind of confirms it.
Yeah. All the long-haul stuff in and out of Chicago.
Mm.
Essentially, so Chicago, New Orleans, Chicago down into Texas, Chicago to Portland, Chicago to Bay Area, Chicago to L.A., Chicago to D.C., Chicago to New York. Those are all showing as probably not. It looks like the Silver Meteor. And what's the, there's another one, the one that goes to Miami or really? New York are both.
The auto train's going away too as part of that.
Hmm. Wow, that's rough.
Yeah. I'm looking at it, I think it looks like. Pretty bad at geography, apparently. I'm trying to look at the couple states here that don't have service, and I can count. It's like Kentucky might not. Like a couple in the Midwest, and then Alaska and Hawaii, obviously. Every other state has service.
Oh, wow.
Maybe five. Maybe five don't. Even like the tip of Kentucky might. So, you know, it's one of those things. Like, it's really hard to get that stripped out from Congress, I would bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Man, oh man. Impossible growth. Let's talk about positive news. St. Helena. St. Helena, there's some pilots and others with Atlantic Star Airlines that are saying, hey, we know that folks want to get to St. Helena and Ascension Islands, and we want to offer that service, and we're trying to figure out a solution because they've had some issues with.
Right, so this is the one where we've talked about this a few times in the past, but this is the one where they built a runway based on the islands in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
And then once they got there, found out like the winds were too rough that they couldn't use it.
Yep. The crosswinds are really bad.
And it was like, wasn't it like a, almost like a wind shear? There was concerns about updrafts at one end of the runway.
I think like the one side is like near a cliff. And so that cliff side is dangerous, and that's the most arrival side. And yeah, a lot of issues there.
Yeah. What's interesting is like the proposal that they seem to be looking at is an Avro.
Yeah.
Which is this nice little regional jet, four engines for short haul. If you flew Swiss regionally within Europe anytime recently, you probably were on one. And I guess the good news is it's four engines, so it's not an ETOPS issue. But beyond that, like, it's still an overwater route. It's still a very long flight. You still need an alternate. Like, there's still all these other things. I'm not sure why that plane would be less susceptible to the wind challenges than a 737. But who the hell knows? But the drama at St. Helena continues.
Yeah. It's yeah, they're we'll post the link to their letter to people. It kind of reads like a press release, like, hey, we're looking into this.
It is a press release. I mean,
it reads just, as like a poor press release, I should say. Like, hey, we know there's a problem. We don't have a solution, but we're looking into it. So if you need to get between those, and I think they're having issues with the ship from what they're saying. Well,
One of the reasons is because they like the whole schedule was based like the ship was cutting its service because they knew that the airport was going to be open, and the ship hasn't returned to service.
So to clarify, St. Helena gets once weekly service from a ship, or did, and this service was going to be cut, and is cut, because the airport. Yes. Which isn't in use. So basically, people are a little stuck. I mean, that's the mail. It's the mail ship. So, yeah.
Anyway. Now here we go. Hang on. Subject to weather conditions, the Avro will land on runway 2 at St. Helena Airport. Runway 2 allows pilots to avoid the wind shear that is sometimes encountered and instead land with the prevailing tailwind. The high-wing four-engine Avro is ideally suited for this type of operation as it has a high-performance braking and undercarriage system, and, uniquely, it has a tail-mounted air brake to assist with stability when airborne and with deceleration once on the ground. Well, I'll be damned.
What do you know?
That last part was me, not the press release. Separate press release on the same page. But, yeah, they think that the plane can land from the other end because it's got better short field performance.
Interesting. Well, let's see what happens.
Yeah, what I'm trying to figure out is what its range is. They're using it to gather. They want to use it as one-offs just to Ascension Island.
Yep.
For medevac and other things like that, because Ascension has better runway service, better air service connectivity options and medical facilities.
Yep. I was going to look up the range on a Avro RJ.
Yeah, they need a long-range RJ-100 variant to be supplied by BAE Systems. Then Cape Town, Windhoek, Joburg, or Accra will become possible.
Interesting. That's a long flight on an Avro.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the range here. The range ranges from, if it's 82 passengers, like 2,000 nautical miles, down to 1,800 nautical miles, depending on the model. So.
Yeah, so there is a long-range version of it, apparently, but go figure.
Yeah. Foz,
yes, sir.
You had a little bit of a
ticketing problem?
Kerfuffle with American?
Yes. Always an adventure. So I'll start this with a question, and I'll get both of your inputs first. You're on a round-trip international itinerary. You've flown your outbound. You go to change your return. What do you think should be the procedure? Fees, what have you?
I'll answer first. I think possible change fee and maybe like a difference in fare for that last segment. Like, you know, if it...
Well, okay, you're not changing city pairs. Same buckets are available.
Same buckets are available. So a change fee and, I'd say a difference in taxes if there is one.
Okay.
Yeah, change fee should apply, and then... Yeah, I mean, right, part of the answer is this always goes back to what was in the fare rules.
Yep.
But typically for most non-refundable, quote-unquote non-changeable, without a fee kind of tickets, the stuff most people buy, it's usually, historically, has been change fee plus fare difference, if any.
Correct.
And if it's same city pair and same fare bucket, there's no fare difference, historically,
in my experience. So that's been my experience, and, I mean, three of us have been doing this for a little while. You know, we're not new at this. Every time I've ever called American to make a change in that situation, they always tell me there's a difference in fare. And I've gotten all sorts of excuses over the years. As you bought 2 one-way fares. Oh, no, fares change all the time. Yada, yada, yada. So I have a ticket that I have to go back that I was for this later this week, and I'm not going to be able to fly it. So I wanted to change it, and it's an international business class ticket. So I call on Friday, and the woman says, oh, no, it's never just a change fee because there's, you know, you bought your ticket in September. Now there's all new fares and what have you. And she's like, so basically, initially they came back with, and the ticket was $960 to begin with. She said there's a difference of fare of $3,600 and a $300 change fee on top of that. I'm like, no. And she's like, well, and so she's talking to the woman in rates and she's talking, and then she's like, oh, we were able to get it down to like $1,900. I'm like, okay, look, can you, like, and this is when I was asking you guys for the where I can get the fare rules. So I'm reading the fare rules. I'm like, eh. So I'm like, well, what fare basis is it using? And she's like, are you a travel agent? I'm like, no. She's like, then what are you going to do with them? I'm like, well, I want to go look at the fare rules. Can you get me the fare rules? Well, I can't give you the fare rules, but I can give you the fare basis. So I get put on hold. She goes back to talking. The rates person comes back. And I said, and at this point, I've pulled up the fare rules. I'm reading them. And she goes, yeah, sir, it'll be that $1,000 or whatever, plus the change fee. I'm like, I'm reading the fare rules right now. And it clearly says, go back. The fare rules on the original day of ticketing are what apply.
Yeah, refare based on historical fares or something like that is the text,
exactly.
Right? I'll read you the exact quote. I have it here.
On day of ticketing or whatever. Exactly. And she goes, you must be a travel agent. I'm like,
the itinerary must be repriced using historical fares in effect on the previous ticketing date.
So I cite that, and she goes, well, I've already disconnected with her, and you must be a travel agent. If you want a different answer, you'll have to call back.
Oh, man. And people wonder why we're ticked off at the airlines.
Yeah. So, you know, this is all Friday, and yesterday I was pretty tied up, so I called today. I get a gentleman on the phone, and I, you know, explain the whole situation, what happened on Friday. I said, look, I'm looking at the fare rules. Here's what I read. And he puts me on the hold. He goes back and comes back and says, yeah, it's just the change fee.
Oh, so he did it really quick.
Yeah, he told rates what I had read, and I guess rates confirmed. But what's funny is the first agent was like, well, the person I spoke to, she's been doing this for years, and she knows how to read those rules too.
Apparently not.
Yeah. So, I mean, and this has always been my experience with American, as far as they just always say there's a difference in fares. So as my little PSA, if you have a change on AA in the year, insisting on refaring, particularly when you've already flown the outbound, go read the fare rules.
Yeah. Historical fare rules are available via Expert Flyer. That's the only place I know to find them if you didn't save them when you bought your ticket.
Yep. And you should save them when you buy your ticket. I would just recommend saving them when you buy your ticket because they're not retrievable on the ticket itself, like when you go into your reservation.
Yeah, there's no other public place to get them. Expert Flyer is the only place I know of.
Yeah. For what it's worth,
I had the same problem on BA. You guys remember this a couple weeks ago. I was changing my ticket to go back over, and like I also was changing city, and they still screwed me. I never got the refund right, and I still have to go back and fight with them. That's one of those, like, I sort of saved $50 somewhere, but then lost $100 somewhere else, and have to decide just how much of this I want to, you know, how much my blood pressure rate or my blood pressure is worth to fight over.
So when I was flying to New York, we were doing some stuff where I had to buy refundable tickets for a while, and I had 1 week where my plans changed. And I needed to change it by a day, and I called United and I said, hey, can I just change it? There's space tomorrow. Can I just change it? Oh yeah, that'll be like $500 or something stupid. And I was like, well, you realize it's a fully refundable ticket. She goes, yeah, it's $500. I just hung up. I hung up the phone, went online, hit cancel, and just bought the other ticket because it was the exact same price. Like, I don't understand how you could charge me $500. And it wasn't even like a change fee should have been applied. It was just,
every now and then it's like, I mean, I've had agents been like, hey, can I list for standby? And yeah, $75. I'm like, would you like to look at my boarding pass that shows that I have status that says it's free, or are you just going to be a pain in my ass? I leave out the pain in my ass part, obviously, because I'm, you know, trying not to get in a fight with gate agents. But
you don't want to get dragged
Well, I wasn't on the plane yet, so I had that going for me. I was trying to get on the plane, so I'm not trying to pick a fight, but like, hi, can you help me? And you answer, you know, gruffly with the wrong information is probably going to piss me off. And that sort of goes, you know, bringing the show full circle. That goes back to the whole concept, the problem I have of like everyone makes it a fight with everybody else, and just like, pretend you care a little bit and go a long way.
Little effort. Yep. Oh, man. Well, guys, I think that's a show. I had one last thing I wanted to talk about. So we put a link on the show's page for something called Patreon. For those of you who don't know what Patreon is, I'll just explain it really quickly. Patreon's like a place where you can support the show. You can donate per episode that we publish. You can donate per month, I believe, as well. So we're playing with it. We're trying to get it settled to see kind of how things go. But if you want to support the show, we're trying to steer away a little bit from sponsorships and ads and things like that. And so if you would like to make Foz's mic sound better, then
for just 30 cents a day,
for just 30 cents a day, you can do that.
Can we get Suzanne Summers to do that voiceover for us? Not that I don't love you, Stephen, but I feel like we missed an opportunity here.
We could tug at heartstrings. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
You can go to the link on the website. We'll post in the show notes as well. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how to get the Patreon set up and how to make the different levels work. But we've talked about some things like possibly having the show streamed live for subscribers and things like that. So if you wanted to listen while we record it, you could do that and you could chat with us. So we're talking about all that stuff, but I wanted to put it out there as something that you can do as a listener if you want. You don't have to. There's no pressure. This show will continue to be free. So anyway. Anything else, guys?
Have a great trip. Hey, Freddy's this week. When you guys are listening to this, I'll be at the Freddy Awards dinner drinking.
Oh, nice. Foz, you going?
I might.
Awesome. I will not.
Since my plans did indeed change, I might make it.
Hope to see you there.
Well, guys, it's been a fun show. Listeners, thanks for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at DotsLines, moredotsmorelines.com. Leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us. Love to hear from you. We're trying to answer some more questions. We have a list of things we're getting to and new shows we come up with. So, yeah. Thanks, guys. Have a good one. Happy flying.
Take care.
Take care.